It's a pleasure to be here. I'm, as Jeff stated, I'm going to be talking about the infrastructure side of things and what, if we're looking to promote data synthesis in evidence-based nutrient management, but also in an evidence-based agronomic practices. So practices that are actually transparent to the data that lie underneath them, and you understand the strength of the inference space if you're looking at it from that particular perspective. I think it's probably useful. I am not a data scientist, but I have been working on data now for a long, long time. And so the things that I am saying today are a reflection of a host of different types of experiences, both in research and in recommendation development, but also in trying to teach students in the lab how to run calibration curves in a soil fertility lab. And so it's this wealth of experience that has motivated me to keep going on data, although I am not a data scientist. So I think really if I had to pick something that was the beginning of my interest in data, it dates back to when I had only been at Purdue a couple years, and I took over overseeing the research activities at Purdue University's Water Quality Field Station. It is an excellent facility for looking at management practice influences on loss of nutrients to water and now as greenhouse gases. When I picked it up, and I hate to say it, but pretty much to date, we have never been funded to manage the data that this facility produces. We have been funded to do the projects and to generate the data, but not to manage it. And one of the values of this facilities, and what allows me to get some internal resources from Purdue, is the argument that the data have value to other resources, that the researchers. It is a bleak landscape that can generate data every second. We do not aggregate, and you're looking at tile flow, we do not aggregate on the second. We could, our data would be bigger, but there are challenges. And so this single goal of trying to make data available to somebody else without me having to be involved has been what has motivated most of what I have done. And I grew up in a bookish family, and my dad was a publisher, my mom has volunteered in the libraries or whatever, and I was looking around, I went to the lawyers first, can I sell data? They're like, who'd buy data? And then I went and I was thinking, okay, well, libraries must surely be looking to do something different in Y2K, given the shift from books to e-resources. And so that is where I went, and that was actually true. At that moment in time, they were thinking about what should we be doing to be of value to a research institution going forward in the electronic era. From my perspective, people in libraries have the right skill sets, and it's the right value proposition. They are dedicated to making intellectual resources available as a public good. And the other key attribute is that they do what I want them to do. You can put stuff there, and they, if it's there and somebody else wanders in, they will help you find that stuff that is there. That is what they do. They annotate, they tag, they make stuff findable. So I thought, okay, that's where we go. A couple of other things that have kind of, been epiphanies for me along the way. Everybody's seen Moneyball. If you saw Moneyball and you thought it was about sports, great, but it's actually about statistics and data. And then also about how people who are paid a lot of money to make good decisions with data available to them often don't actually use that data. So there's a subsequent article that was written in Vanity Fair where somebody interviewed Michael Lewis about this question, why do professional baseball executives make such colossal mistakes And it's really about the human mind and how we think about, you know, how we're familiar with various things and then are willing to overlook data. And to me, that was really interesting because I started thinking about the extension specialist. What does the extension specialist do? Is the extension specialist really looking at all the data? A few other points of motivation, and then I'll move to the rest of the story. But I was also asked about 2013 to look at the literature surrounding conservation agriculture in sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia and answer the simple question, in general, is conservation ag increasing, decreasing, or maintaining yields? And we couldn't complete that activity because the literature was too variable and incomplete to aggregate it. So this problem of trying to put papers together, we could have done it if there was more information, but the literature was too incomplete. I've also worked on CAME recommendations. I have a very famous long-term five-year study at Purdue, which the people always harass me about it because it's been going on now for 17, 18 years. And we're still trying to address some questions, but the knowledge gained out of that is that it's really hard to get enough data from enough different locations to underpin a strong recommendation. And that has made me think about how can we look at farmer data to supplement research data, because we're never going to have enough researchers or enough money in the research space to do the things we want to do to generate data. And finally, for many reasons, I've tended to look at other disciplines. And so medicine, I'm a big, you know, here, unlike agriculture where I make recommendations, in medicine I am a consumer of recommendations. And when I've been thinking about what I do to make recommendations in agriculture, started me wondering, what do they do in medicine? How do I know that they're doing a better job in making a recommendation to me than I know about what I'm doing in making a recommendation to a farmer? And so I've started to look at how science, the science of medicine, puts data together. And they are doing some things that are really interesting and really useful. Tamiflu is a great example. If you don't know about the studies on Tamiflu, you'll know that the policy got out ahead of the science, and our government put many zeros of money into stockpiling Tamiflu, only to find out that if we had a pandemic, it wasn't going to save a single life. It might make us slightly less miserable for a few hours, but it wasn't going to save our lives. Here's another example. Often people say to me, well, your data aren't interesting because it's not big. And this is a great discussion of making big data out of small data in neuroscience. So this article on data sharing in the long tail of neuroscience, again, made me think. And they had a graph in there about data size on the X, a number of data sets on the X axis and the size on the Y axis. And really, there are very few places in science where there are these mega data sets that lots of scientists are working on the same data set. The majority of us are working on smaller data sets, but the number of those data sets on a particular topic is quite large. So, for example, in nitrogen management, 4Rs, right? There are lots and lots of us doing 4R research on an array of relevant questions, not exactly the same. We're not producing the same data set. We're not working. We're creating our own data sets, and those data sets could be assembled. There are also, in nutrient management, a lot of data that are dark. They are, quote, beyond the literature limit. They are not published. They are sitting out there in the gray literature, and as such, they are not necessarily accessible. I was reminded painfully of this concerning a guide I wrote when I was bucking for tenure with Dev Mengel back in, I don't know, 97 or something like that, and on the pre-sidrus nitrate test. And we developed an AY, a guide for farmers on using the PSNT. It has some very specific recommendations about how to sample if the field has a history of banded manure. Very specific. And Sarah Mueller, graduate student down the hall, wandered into my office in late July and said, could I see the data that underpins this recommendation? And I just said, sigh. Actually, those were Dave Mengel students, and I can't remember their names. And then I was just like, okay, thinking, what did I do? Well, actually what I did was I photocopied two theses, and I had them in the binder with PSNT written on the binder on my shelf. And after I, you know, thought a few minutes, I looked up, I was like, oh, there they are. And I went and handed it to him. She actually picked up the raw data because Dave had his students put it in there. But those theses, I could not remember their names. Those individuals are not cited in that AY. And so, therefore, even if you could find these 1992-93 theses, you wouldn't be able to easily access them. It predates our e-era. So this dark data issue is pretty big, pretty important. There are a lot of examples, if you start looking around, of dark research data. There's orphan data. That's increasing now. More and more of us collect data on stuff that we don't actually get into a publication, but we're facilitated by tools and technologies to just collect a lot of data. There are null or failed studies that we don't bother to publish. Null hypothesis. We proved it that, in fact, this doesn't work. Nobody's particularly interested in that, and we probably don't even bother to write it up. Yet, if you're making a recommendation about using that technology, that data ought to inform the recommendation. It didn't matter. That data ought to be there. Confirmatory studies also don't tend to get published because of the culture in our peer review journal system where they're looking for novel results, not same old, not I found this here too in Indiana. All of those are important data to a recommendation. If we're looking more broadly to try to look where we can get more data, looking on the farm, data collected by CCAs, monitoring data off of equipment, there's a lot of data being generated on farm. We can say, oh gosh, it's not as high quality as research data. All you need to do is know about the quality. It does all, you know, there's some pretty bad research data too, but you know, if you know. So just to kind of summarize, we've been on this long pathway. It's a 17, 20-year trip we've been on. It's been supported by a group of people that I want to acknowledge broadly, including IP&I. They've been great partners, our libraries. The deans have been supportive. Paul Fixon was fantastically supportive prior to his retirement, so IP&I has been a great partner. We have been, we wrote our first proposal on data management and data sharing in 2004 to USDA, and it was rejected flatly, lowest priority, with the comment, who would share their data? So at least things have changed. In the meantime, we have done a lot of different, we've tried a lot of things. We had pilot projects. That's how I learned about how little I know about data and how little my students, digital natives, people who grew up with apps and stuff, how little they know about data. And how that is a barrier. I do other things, so, you know, it's, and then there are many things that you bump up against in trying to figure out how to share data. There are attitudes, there's ownership issues, lots of absence of policy, but I think we're moving along in the right direction. We're still focused on libraries as using the information scientists in libraries to help us. Scott and I had the opportunity earlier this year to think up kind of, all right, we've been working in one spot, which I'll finish up talking about, and that's this biggest wheel. But what does a whole nutrient management evidence-based recommendation system look like? And if your goal is to have something at the end that your stakeholders feel is customizable, credible, as a recommendation, it isn't waiting on you to go back and look at new data added. It's got some mechanisms for self-improvement. It uses new data as it's introduced, and it can be modified for non-agronomic priorities. I mean, that's sort of like the holy grail of a great nutrient management recommendation. If you look at what's got to underpin this, we're talking about some serious analytical capability. big data analytics, maybe, I don't know. But there are, even if you get away from the excitement and, as Scott says, the furiously wagging tails of big data, there are some things that are very useful that are being used elsewhere that we're not using yet, and they consider machine learning, deep learning, artificial intelligence, et cetera. It doesn't mean that you're just giving up the professional's role in supervising, but there's some unsupervised stuff that I think could be incredibly useful to us, looking for proxy measures, things we haven't thought about, and then probably some tools so that you can interface with your artificial intelligence and explore the unexpected. At the foundation of all of this is what we've been doing at Purdue, and that's looking at the infrastructure for ingesting and organizing data in real time. We've also been trying to pick up historical data as we go along, but the real-time thing and the historical data, both of them are challenging. It's certainly less cool. If you look at what's got to have, you got to have some way to get data into the place. You've got to have workflows that either prompt the person entering this place to make the data interoperable and to check for quality assurance and quality control. And they have to be simple and user-friendly. You may need to figure out how you're going to handle public-private issues. If you're looking at combining, you have to have some mechanisms to do that, different sorts of data. And this notion, where are you going to, this of archiving and preserving, not just storing. So you get away from problems like bit rot or websites, you know, broken linkages to websites, that kind of thing. There are a lot of challenges that are confronting data generators and downstream data users. We have dealt with lots of them. I think right now the one that sort of bugs me the most, because I see the least progress, even within Purdue, is who's going to pay for this? What's the business model for this? I think if we had somebody with like a clear way that this is going to get paid for, I still don't get money from AFRI-NIFA proposals specifically for making the data. They want me to do it, but they don't fund it the way it needs to be funded. We focused on these persistent problems, the fact that we're looking at small data sets that are dispersed. They're heterogeneous. How do you bring them together? And the need to have provenance to understand what you're actually looking at. So that provenance word, where you're moving beyond just storing stuff, but storing it in a way that's meaningful, that allows it to be reused. So you're moving into the preservation curation. Storage is cheap. Preservation curation is expensive. That is what I've been told over and over again by the information scientists. You can store it now, but you can't preserve or create it without spending more money. So a data repository is just a mechanism for achieving that preservation curation. It can be a physical repository that uses non-physical space, but it can be a physical repository, or it can be something like a data publication. A data publication has a DOI, it makes it persistent in space and time. It is not a website, not a database, not a network, blah, blah, blah. It is something different than that. There are no perfect solutions out there right now to this data repository or data, making data available as a public good. There are lots of things that go on that move it out of the public good. But I think there are a bunch of things that are being tried. There's a soft money NSF solution. Problem is, it's soft money. Dryad is a repository, but it only takes data from things that are published. So it doesn't solve the dark data problem or the gray lit problem. Our professional societies are debating it. It's in their strategic plan now. Now they're thinking about, or for A and for C, not yet for S, but they're trying to think about, well, now what do we do? We have it as an objective, but what do we do to realize that objective? National Ag Libraries has their Ag Data Commons, which is you can publish data through, and then there we have our own repository. Many institutions are beginning on to develop these. In our efforts with the repositories for nutrient management stuff, we have been working behind what I call this interoperability curtain. We are in the space behind where your data are discovered. We are working on the conceiving of data, collecting, describing, etc. Recognizing that if your data are going to be shared, it better be part of the plan from the very beginning. Retrofitting a data set after you've completed it for sharing is a lot more work than getting it right in the first place. So this is, you know, if you're working upstream of interoperability, this is basically grunt work, and you're thinking about tools to annotate, to put in metadata, etc. Other side, it's cool, it's exciting, you make new knowledge, whatever. So consequently, lots of people thinking about what to do here, not so many people thinking about what to do upstream behind interoperability. It's just, I remember talking to IBM, they're like, well, we don't do data processing, we do big data analytics. I'm like, okay, well, you can't do it until you have the data, so you're going to be waiting a while. The goal, and it's for both PER, but we have this for our research repository, which is a repository within a repository. It is a 4R fund project. And we are for management of project data that they have funded. We're simply trying to make the data discoverable, accessible, intelligent, intelligible, accessible, that provenance issue. Do you know what it is? Do you know what the quality is? And then generally usable. Is it in an actionable format? So an actionable format does not mean that all the data are that you're collecting from different studies are the same, but they're in a format where you could put them through some simple processing to make them the same. But there's enough information that you know what they are. And websites are, never think a website is persistent. I think we're all aware of that. And I'm not going to talk about it, but to get to actually achieving this on a regular basis, we're going to have to be teaching new things. The infrastructure, just quickly, PER is it's a great tool. It's like, you know, the randomized complete block design, what it was in the 50s, this is what the research repository is. You can publish. It's much more than data storage, although you can store data there, and they will back it up for you. It's based on some middleware that NSF funded the development of. It's this hub cyber environment. But there's a workspace, there are tools, you can post models, blah, blah, blah. But you can publish and get a DOI for your data set. It works you through from the very beginning of the data life cycle. So now you want to apply for a grant, you need a data management plan, you can go there and you can say, I'm applying to USDA, AFRINIFA. They say you need boom, 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 these elements, here's the language for this section, here's the language for this section, you know, and you have your two-page data management plan. And it goes all the way through publishing your data set. We happened to be, it was a nutrient management data set that was the very first one that was published via PER, and it was a little pilot project. How does this work? You know, what do we do? And it was published in 2012. You can go download it. You can search for it. It's been tagged the way you would tag an article. With terms, we're trying to standardize terms for using those from National Ag Library. You can put your grant number in. You can load up supporting documents that are downloadable. And in this case, a data dictionary describing what every single column in that data set is. There's a summary, which is basically your materials and methods. And it's backed up every 12 hours, four places around North America. So I don't have to worry about my office, fires in the building, et cetera. You can't put sensitive data. The workflow for the 4R project is based upon this, and it's for ag data. We in our 4R project, we have people that are helping project directors that are funded through the 4R funds to get their data in shape to be published. And there's this management and preservation that is not by the PI. The other thing I think that's important is that they're embargo. Everybody's like worried about, well, what if I'm not ready to publish? Embargoing methods are built in. In this case, we're negotiating with IPNI and the 4R Fund on what they want for embargoing. But it's all, you know, available, and help is there for signing DOIs, supporting documentation, etc. Last words, toughest lesson. You can't just build repositories and expect people to use it. It's not part of our culture yet. You have to help, and many data needs special treatment. In the 4R project, we have this thing called a data buddy to help people one-on-one get their data into shape, start from the very beginning, learn new skills. The challenge is that it's really hard to find people who can do this. Young youth, the digital natives, don't necessarily have an understanding of all the different ways an agronomic researcher might put together agronomic data. Someone like myself either doesn't have the skill set or the time to do it, even though they might know people collect data in all different kinds of ways. Not all data are knowledge, and not all knowledge is actionable. So when we look at aggregating all this data, we can't get wildly excited about every piece of data. We have to think hard about what data are useful, and I think that leads me to my final thought. Scott mentioned it, but I'm really focused on trying to teach students how to annotate their data and organize it so someone has a prayer of opening an Excel file and knowing what it is. And so I think the second biggest mistake that we tend to make is this templates issue. Not because templates aren't a good idea for like collaborative projects, maybe like Global Maize, or Jorge's gonna talk about the new ONET project, but if you're looking at aggregating data from a wealth of different places, the single most important thing is you understand the metadata for a cell in a database, the metadata for a column, and what the experiment was. And if we could just achieve that, we would achieve so much more.
Outstanding. Let's give Sylvia a hand.